This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw LLP for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion of any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you might have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. At this time, I would like to turn today's program over to Robert Milligan, partner in the Los Angeles office of Seyfarth Shaw. Mr. Milligan, you may now begin.
Thank you so much, and thank you to the audience for joining us today. Thank you for today's presentation is Trade Secret and Non-Compete Considerations in Asia. I'd like to introduce you to today's panel. We are joined by Juan Lee. Juan Lee is a managing partner of Seyfarth Shanghai office. He has over 20 years of experience in China-related matters, advising a diverse range of clients in employment, mergers and acquisitions, private equity, and corporate matters, including restructuring. He has a broad practice focused on foreign direct investments into China and representing Chinese companies in relation to multi-jurisdictional transactions, including acquisitions of equity and assets of foreign energy and resource companies. He's a member of the International Seyfarth Employment Group. We are also joined by an associate in the Shanghai office, Leon Mao. He's also in the International Employment Group. He specializes in the full spectrum of employment transactions under Chinese laws. He has successfully negotiated and documented numerous employment documents for multinational clients, designed employee transfer structures, and arranged personal transfer and drafted relevant transactional documents. He's also arranged personnel allocation and compensation in mergers and acquisitions and handled all aspects of labor disputes, labor arbitration, and litigation involving multinational clients operating in China. We are also joined by Dominic Hodson. Dominic is also in the International Employment Group. He's a partner in the San Francisco office of Seyfarth Shaw. Dominic specializes in the firm's international labor and employment practice and has devoted his career to the development of his niche practice. He works regularly and closely with some of the world's best-known brands to assist them with all of their labor and employment needs outside of the United States and guides them to compliance and commercially practical resolutions of those needs. I'm Robert Milligan, and I'm a partner in the litigation and labor and employment departments of Seyfarth Shaw in its Los Angeles office. My practice encompasses a wide variety of commercial litigation and employment matters. My practice focuses on trade secret, non-compete, and data protection litigation and transactional work on a state, national, and international platform. We're very happy you joined us today. We have quite the schedule for the audience. The topics slated for today's discussion include standards for enforceability of non-compete and non-disclosure agreements in China, including a recent case discussion. That particular portion of the program will be handled by Juan Li and Leon Mao. We'll also discuss standards for protecting trade secret and confidential information in China, including an overview of remedies, court administration, and the typical timeline. That will also be handled by Juan Li and Leon Mao. We'll also look at practical considerations for U.S. companies and multinational companies doing business in China to effectively protect their trade secrets and confidential information. Juan Li and Leon Mao will also take care of that particular topic. Now, Dominic Hodson will get into a comparison of China to other Asian countries regarding non-compete and trade secret considerations. And then finally, I'll get into challenges that U.S. companies face in pursuing trade secret and non-compete claims against Chinese individuals and companies in the United States, including a discussion of some recent ITC actions, the Economic Espionage Act, and a recent case law discussion. With that, it's my pleasure to turn the presentation over to Juan Li for a discussion regarding non-compete agreements and trade secret issues in China.
Thank you, Robert. It's great to have the opportunity to talk to everyone. I think it's here is the stand for enforceability of a non-compete and non-disclosure agreements in China, including recent case discussion. And I think it will be helpful to have some overviews about Chinese legal systems first. So the first thing I want to touch on is the Chinese legal system is civil law system is quite different from the common law or case law system like in the United States. And also, the Chinese legal system is more sort of a unitary system, so quite different from the Americans, the federal systems. So in America, you have a different, with the federal law system and also state system. But in China, it's just a one from the central government, a central law. And then they will be pushed down to the local, provincial, and city system. And of course, Chinese law is in development in the start from about 40 years ago. So quite different from in the United States, you have more than 200 years. And so with that in mind, we will see that the quite an imbalance and inconsistencies in the Chinese law implementation in different city and province. And the other things that really touch on the basic principle is the in China, executive government has a great influence on the judicial system. So the black letter laws will have some sort of a gap in the Chinese legal system, so the black letter laws and the enforcement. So with all these in mind, now we come down to the non-compete and also trade secret issue. In China, non-compete limited to senior managers, senior technical personnel, and employees with access to trade secrets. So it is very important that in relation to what is the trade secret in China, there is some sort of requirement, definition that Leon will touch on later on. Once you put that in mind to make sure what is this trade secret, and then you can deal with the different employees and technical personnel and senior managers. Otherwise, you will miss out. For example, in one of the Chinese case that the company had the confidential information, but the employees disclosed that confidential information to the third party. When the company sued the employee, the court said, you said this is confidential information, but you failed to take some measure and put some label on, or you have some procedure to manage that confidential information. So in the end, the company failed to pursue that case. In relation to the time limit, non-compete in China, there is a limit, no more than 2 years. But a company and can negotiate to sort of a short term, is like a half year, 1 year, the limit is to 2 years. There is a compensation requirement for the non-compete agreement, the obligation on employees. The company is required to pay compensation. For many years, there is a different cities, province in China. There is a different view as to what the compensation should be, how much the company should pay. Some just pay 1 month, some maybe pay half years. And start from early this year, there's sort of a very authoritative construction as to what should be. So the compensation now requires around 30% of the last 12 months average salary of that particular employee. Of course, there is an additional condition that if that 30% of that particular employee's last 12 months' monthly salary is lower than the local minimum wage, then the minimum wages will apply. And in China, we all know the injunctive relief was very difficult to obtain. Fortunately, recently, there is a new amendment to the Chinese civil law, a civil procedure law, and there is also a couple of new cases. A very high profile one is the one early this year, Shanghai Intermediate Court handed down in relation to the relief. Leon is going to touch on that. Other than the relatively difficult to get an injunctive relief, usually is a limited damage are very common and usually should not be more than 130%. That's the maximum, but usually it's really depend on the circumstances. Trade secret protected by Chinese law. As I mentioned earlier, the law and enforcement, there is a huge gap. So it is very important to, when we figure out how to protect the trade secret, the detail and specific thing in the contract is very, very important. And now we'll hand over to my colleague, Leon, for the next slide.
Thank you, Wan Li. Next, I would like to share with you some matters regarding trade secrets. I mean, the standards for protecting trade secrets and confidential information in China, and also remedies on court administration, as well as a typical timeline. First, how to identify trade secrets in China. Chinese law provides three elements. First, it is not known to the public. And the second, it has economic value. The third, it is protected by the owner. In a recent case in China, the court ruled that the logistic information of goods uploaded to a company's website by visitors does not constitute a trade secret, mainly for two reasons. Reason one, the logistic information is obtained through a public channel without any cost, which shall not be regarded as information not known to the public. And reason two, the company has not taken any protective measures, such as setting a password for the logistic information. Next, about the remedies. In case of suspected trade secrets misappropriation, the owners can undertake several actions to enforce their trade secret rights, including civil litigation, criminal prosecution, as well as administrative action. An injured party can take civil action in a Chinese court to seek compensation for damages. Other than civil means, criminal prosecution should always be considered as an enforcement option when the trade secret owner has suffered serious losses. Serious is defined by the Supreme Court from time to time. Under the 2004 interpretation, it refers to loss above 81,000 US dollars. Generally speaking, criminal prosecution is very effective, but it is not always easy to get police interested in common cases, which is not high profile. As for administrative approach, a specific Chinese governmental authority, Administration for Industry and Commerce, has powers to investigate, order to return or destruct materials containing trade secrets, or even impose civil fines from $1,600 to $32,000. Next, I would like to share with you a very brief court administration in China. The court system in China consists of local courts, the Supreme Court, and special courts such as military courts. Local courts are divided into three levels: basic courts, intermediate courts, and higher courts. As for trials in China, there are no juries. Generally, there could be two instances for each trial, and almost any case can be appealed or retried, as the case may be. A typical timeline for a trial in China, specifically for a civil trial concerning trade secrets, and injunctive relief will be released by the court within 48 hours when it is very urgent. But according to a recent case, generally the injunctive relief is granted within around a month. While the final ruling of the court really depends on how many instances to go through, considering the case which are appealed or retried, the whole process may take years. Next, how to prove that trade secret misappropriation? First, in China, you know, although Chinese laws provide adequate statutory protection of trade secrets, but you know, approving trade secrets infringement is legal proceeding can be very evidence intensive and time consuming. So to prevail in a trade secret misappropriation cases, plaintiffs must present sufficient evidence, including first, the existence and ownership of the trade secrets, which meets the statutory requirements, including the medium on which the trade secret is carried, the commercial value of the trade secret, and also the protective measures taken by the owner. Secondly, the plaintiff should also prove that the defendant has obtained the information that is identical or substantially identical to a trade secret. And third, the defendant has used improper means to obtain or use a trade secret. Next, I would like to share you with a recent Shanghai trade secret decision, which is the China's first ban on the circulation of trade secrets. This was deemed as a landmark ruling for IP in China. This case is brand new. The decision was released on August 2nd this year. The case was between Eli Lilly, the U.S. drug giant, and one of its former employees. This former employee, who has executed a confidentiality agreement with the company, has downloaded 21 documents containing the company's business secrets without any authorization. Then the company discovered this and terminated this employee's employment and request him to delete all these documents, but the employee refused to delete any. So the company then sued for injunction to prevent using or circulating the trade secrets, and also demanded compensation was $3.26 million, and also applied for custody of these trade secrets. The court judged in favor of the company, which is the very first ruling of this kind in China, under a revised civil procedure law enacted on January 1st this year. Under such amendment of civil procedure law, the court could release injunctive relief. Next, I'll touch on some practical considerations for U.S. companies doing business in China to protect their trade secrets effectively in practice. First, we would like to suggest companies pay much attention to prophylactic measures rather than remedies. Those prophylactic measures include, first, provide an employee with training regarding trade secrets. The company should keep the meeting minutes for training, which could prove that the employees are aware of these are trade secrets. Secondly, the company should also take periodic audits on compliance of confidentiality policy. And also, we advise the company that should establish a confidentiality policy specifying that any breach of confidential obligation would result in immediate termination of employment. Further, the company should also mark all trade secret materials with confidential label so the employees will know that this is confidential. And also, IT solutions are also important in this regard, including adopt encryption technology, set passwords, restrict access to certain information, and also keep logs of visitors so the company can know when and who has access to what kind of information. And also, the company should require visitors to sign confidential agreements prior to visits. And with all this, we would like to remind the company that maintaining a good documentary record are very important. We have mentioned all these documentaries, such as the meeting minutes, and also these confidential agreements we mentioned. And last, hiring former employees of a competitor may lead to certain confidential risks. Therefore, we suggest the template of employment contract contains clauses which deal with the candidate's confidential as well as non-compete obligation towards former employer. Okay, now I would like to hand to Robert. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Wan Li and Leon. We appreciate the presentation there. I will now turn it to our next presenter, Dominic Hodson.
Thanks, Robert. Thanks, Wan Li, and thanks, Leon. I am charged today with just doing a little bit of a comparison and a little bit of an outline when talking about some of the other Asian countries where companies and employers commonly find themselves doing business in Asia. I think one of the things to remember about Asia, and Wan Li touched upon it, is that each country is very different in how it's set up, in how its laws are set up, and how its court systems are set up. You do not necessarily have a unifying principle, as say you might in Europe, where the directors of the European Union have the effect of certainly bringing certain subjects together, nor in South America and Latin America, where you tend to have a very heavy influence from Spanish and in some cases Portuguese law. In Asia, we're really dealing with a real melting pot of influences into putting laws together. So you have some socialist countries, you have countries which have based their laws on civil law through the Dutch or through Spanish influences, you have countries which are a combination. You have countries which are really just developing their laws for the first time in any kind of codified sense, such as China and then Cambodia. Ever since the late 70s, it's had to go through a whole process of rebuilding there. So you really do have a mix. And when you're going into Asia and when you're looking at issues in Asia, you really do need to keep that in mind, because what works in one place is not necessarily going to work in the next place. And so moving that in, it's quite apt to start with Hong Kong, because we've talked about China and then we talk about Hong Kong in the next breath, but Hong Kong is still part of China. And it's very easy to forget, but it is, if you're talking about what country is Hong Kong, well, Hong Kong is China. And yet the legal system in Hong Kong couldn't be any further from the legal system in China. China is very codified. You have not necessarily precedents being binding. You have very pithy, very short laws where there's interpretation being built in. Hong Kong is a common law country. It's inherited its legal system from the United Kingdom. And it has a very comprehensive set of statutes, as you would see in the United States. And then it also has a great deal of court-developed law through the common law. Hong Kong has developed its common law from the UK. And so you see a lot of common principles that are shared with the UK. And if you are looking for a unifying system in Asia, perhaps the common law creates or represents the best chance for bringing certain regions and countries together, because there are a number of former England colonies which have drawn their legal systems from the common law. So when you're looking at it, you look at Singapore, you look at Malaysia, you look at Hong Kong, India, Australia, and then New Zealand. Quite a bit of similarity, and then particularly when you're looking at restrictive covenants and trade secrets, in how they tend to address these issues, because they tend to be influenced by the common law. And when we're talking about non-competes and trade secrets, you find that most of the law in these countries is actually set by the common law. India and Malaysia are two exceptions, because there's been actually statutory encroachment upon the common law, but otherwise the law tends to be developed by the common law. And what does the common law in Hong Kong, as it applies in Hong Kong, have to say about non-competes in an employment context? Well, perhaps unsurprisingly to those of you familiar with US concepts, which again is shaped by the common law, a non-compete will generally be void as against public policy unless an employer can show that it is reasonable to protect a legitimate business interest. And when we're talking about in non-compete in this context, we're talking about a post-termination non-compete. Generally, a non-compete during the period of employment, and I think this is fairly common across the region, a non-compete during the period of employment is going to be enforceable as either part of the duty of fidelity or loyalty or just part of the good faith which an employee owes to an employer. But once the employment ends, an employer cannot enforce a non-compete against a former employee unless it's reasonable in the circumstances. So what are some of the things that go into making or a decision as to whether things are reasonable in the circumstances? Well, first of all, you need to look at, well, what's the proprietary interest, or what is the interest that the employer is trying to protect? Now, often, the employer would just like the employee not to be competing against. That, of course, is not enough. What are some of the other interests, though? Well, obviously, trade secrets. If you're looking at a way, well, this is the only way that we can protect our trade secrets, that's going to be one of the acceptable ways in which you can see a non-compete enforced. Proprietary business information, I've obviously put that up. That's not that far away from a trade secret. It's also confidential information. Another, of course, is a customer connection, part of the goodwill of the business. It's recognizing that the employee builds up, by virtue of his or her employment, a special relationship with a customer, and that relationship actually belongs to the employer. It will take the employer some time to rebuild that relationship when the employee leaves, and in certain circumstances and appropriate circumstances, where the employee does have an unfair advantage, the courts are going to say in Hong Kong, well, yes, we'll allow the employer to protect that. The other aspects, though, also need to be considered. You have to say, well, if it's reasonable in scope, time, and geographic limitation. So the scope is, well, you can't go any further in Hong Kong than is necessary to protect that business interest. The classic case is, say you have a business which is involved in a bunch of different lines, product lines, and then you have a non-compete and there's cases on this, and you have a non-compete which prevents the employee from competing against the employer. What that might mean is that the employee is prevented from competing against the employer in a business where the employee actually has no information or has no real ability to damage the employer. That in itself will mean that the non-compete is void because it goes beyond what is necessary to protect the employer's interest, which is really just to stop the employee working in the business in which she or he has been working while at the employer. Again, you need to have a restriction in time. Hong Kong is perhaps a bit more restrictive than perhaps some of the other common law countries in this regard. 6 months, once it gets over 6 months, the courts are going to start looking quite closely at the non-compete, and it's very rare, I would say, to see a non-compete longer than 12 months be enforced in Hong Kong. So they really do keep an eye on how long the non-compete is going to be enforced. And then finally, the geographic limitation. Well, is it reasonable to protect yourself worldwide? Is it reasonable to protect yourself only in Hong Kong? What about Greater China? There is some latitude here. I think this is the one where there's more flexibility. The cases in Hong Kong, you have seen worldwide non-competes enforced. But again, you need to show that the area that the non-compete has effect in, it's no broader than what is absolutely necessary. In Hong Kong, if you get the non-compete wrong, it's going to be fatal to the whole non-compete. The courts might sever discrete parts of a non-competition obligation if it can keep the clause whole and if it can keep meaning to the clause. You'll need a severance obligation or a severance right under the contract, of course, but they are not going to rewrite your contract for you. So if you get it wrong, if you overreach and the court can't sever discrete parts and still make the contract make sense, the whole non-compete will be struck down. Do you need to pay for a non-compete in Hong Kong? We've already heard from Wan Lee and Leon that compensation during the non-compete period is an essential part of enforcing the non-compete in China. In Hong Kong, that's not the case. Whether or not you pay someone during the period of non-competition isn't really germane to the idea of is it effective or not. You do need consideration. So if the employee signs the non-compete at the time they start employment, then consideration is usually present. But if you're asking the employee to sign a non-compete partway through employment, if you do not have consideration, then that could be an issue for you. So that's always something to keep in mind. You may not need to pay for the non-compete per se, but you are still going to need consideration for it. You have injunctive relief in Hong Kong, which is very important, of course. It's often difficult to show damages in a non-competition situation, and injunctive relief is probably your best avenue for getting relief. And it's not dissimilar from the systems that we're familiar to here in the United States. Moving on again to trade secrets here. Trade secret, again, there's no definition of trade secrets under the Hong Kong law. There's no specific statute which protects trade secrets under Hong Kong law. In very rare occasions, you might be able to bring or encourage the police to bring a criminal action if you can show that there actually has been a straight-out misappropriation of property, but it's a pretty high barrier to cross. Most of the times, you're going to be needing to rely on either a contractual right of confidentiality or an equitable right of confidentiality. In terms of non-compete, in terms of what is a trade secret, again, no strict definition, but you're looking at the common ideas. Is the information known within a particular field, or is it only known to the employer? Has the employer taken steps to protect it? And is the information actually of commercial value? Without those things, it's very difficult to prove that the information should actually be considered as so confidential that it should actually receive protection of law. Again, your remedies, damages can be quite difficult, but because it's an equitable, you recognise equitable remedies in Hong Kong, you can get an accounting of profits. So when you're looking at Hong Kong, it's very different from China. And it can be quite useful when you're looking at, and we'll talk about this towards a bit more to the end, when you're looking at setting up employment arrangements, which is going to be more favourable to you and where is the employee actually going to be based? Because you have, at least on one hand, you have some certainty in China with the non-compete as long as they meet the threshold of being in management and they have the requisite confidential information. As long as you pay for it, you have in Hong Kong a bit less certainty about enforceability, but you do, I think, probably have a bit more confidence in just how the court system is set up. So Hong Kong's a very, it's an interesting contrast with China. I'm going to move on, and I'll move through a bit more quickly with some of the remaining countries, because I did want to talk about Hong Kong, because it really is the closest comparison that you have for China. India is really the Wild West if you're looking at non-competition and trade secrets. No specific regulation under statutes for trade secrets. A non-compete, a post-termination non-compete, is just straight-out void in India. So there's no idea that it's legitimate to protect your business interests or it's reasonable in the circumstances. It's just straight-out void. So you cannot actually protect yourself from competition once the employee leaves. What are some of the things you might be able to do? Well, you might have an extended notice period. So if the employee resigns, the employee then is required to give you 3 months' notice of termination. Unfortunately, it's quite common in India for the employee just to leave immediately anyway and just pay you as the employer the notice period out. And the employee will actually get reimbursed by the new employer. It's a reimbursement of notice pay. It's quite a common benefit in India. If you have a fixed term contract, that's another way to perhaps protect yourself, because the employee is required to is going to be liable for damages. But then if you have a fixed term contract, it's also quite hard for yourself to get out. Again, trade secret protection based on your common law rights, of which there's not that many, and contract. In India, I would say it is absolutely essential. If you want to have any chance of protecting your trade secrets or protecting your confidential information, you need a non-disclosure agreement, a very tight non-disclosure agreement formed with the person to whom you're disclosing. You should think about having an arbitration provision in there. The courts in India are notoriously clogged up. When you look at decisions being handed down, it's often 7-8 years from when when the action was actually initiated. So arbitration is a way to perhaps move things a bit more smoothly. But without a very solid contract, you are going to really expose yourself, I would say, in India to trade secret loss, and also from employees leaving and taking your confidential information with you, simply because there's no other way for you to effectively protect yourself. I then just move on to Japan. Japan obviously is not a common law country. It's a codified country. And Japan has actually got some pretty good protections in the realms of, I would say, trade secret protection through its unfair competition laws. And then it also allows for non-competes to be enforced against employees. Now, there's a number of factors which the courts are going to take into account in deciding whether or not a non-compete for an employee is reasonable after they leave. They're going to look at circumstances such as, well, what is the interest that you're protecting? Is it special technology that you're protecting? Are you protecting your know-how? Is it something that you actually need protection for? You look at the restriction then, and then a lot of focus comes down on, well, does the employee know what they can and cannot do? So you look at the words used to restrict the employee. Is it clear to the employee what they can and cannot do? How important was the employee to you as the employer? If they're a senior employee, if they're in research and development, well, then they're quite important to you. But if they're a fairly low-level salesperson, is it really reasonable to protect yourself from that kind of employee? How clear and reasonable is the geography and the length of the non-compete? Again, I don't think Japanese courts are not going to mind, I would say, going beyond a few months. They'll enforce longer periods if you're looking at, say, perhaps Hong Kong. But again, you need to have precision about the geography, and you need to have precision about the length the non-compete's in effect for. And then finally, well, do you need to pay people? Again, you're not required to pay people, but it is certainly a factor that is going to be taken into account in whether the non-compete is reasonable. And I would say that it's a lot easier for you to say, well, I'm paying the person during the period of non-compete, therefore I should be able to enforce it. So a bit similar, I would say, there to China, again, where the expectation under the law is, well, yes, you should pay for it. Compare and contrast to Hong Kong, even if you pay for it, well, you may not get any benefit for it. Injunctive relief is available in Japan, so again, that's quite useful. Trade secrets are protected by statute. You've got the Unfair Competition Prevention Act. So the definition of trade secrets under that act, again, it's that fairly common definition which we tend to be used to in countries where there is a statutory definition. The information can't be publicly known. The information needs to be useful for commercial activities, and the information needs to be used, stored, and controlled in a way that indicates that it is confidential information. Again, under the Act, there's the right to get injunctive relief, and there's the right to get damages. And it's a civil, there's the ability to enforce it on a civil basis, so it provides quite a good avenue for people to protect their confidential information. Again, I would say to you that it is important to have appropriate contracts. And when you look at that, there are actually other things you can do with an employee in the field of non-competition that can help you with that. In Japan, employers of a particular size are required to have internal work regulations. It's like a handbook, but it actually takes more effect than a handbook. It is something that is legally binding upon employees. As part of those regulations, which apply commonly to all employees, you can build in non-competition obligations. And you can also build into the retirement allowance, and it says retirement, it's not retirement in the Western sense. When you hear of people retiring in Japan, it often means that they're just leaving one opportunity and moving to another because of the difficulty involved in firing people in Japan. But it's very common in those circumstances when people leave an employer, even when they resign, is that they get a payout of a retirement allowance, which is just another form of severance. So I would say in those circumstances, if an employee then goes and competes against you, you sometimes see in the retirement allowance the right to actually take money away from the employee as a, in effect, a punishment for going to compete against the employer. So something a bit different there that you wouldn't necessarily see in China, you certainly don't see in Hong Kong, but another practical way in which you can protect yourself. I'm going to keep moving along to our next country, Taiwan. Taiwan's quite interesting, and we'll come to that an additional slide after this. In the frame of non-competition, the courts are quite hostile to non-competes. But then again, they tend to take an approach not dissimilar to the way that the Japanese courts approach it. They look at, and we can all read the list here, but again, how important is the employee? Are they actually going to know the information that you're trying to protect? Are you proposing a reasonable limitation on their activities? You know, are you stopping them from doing anything, or are you just stopping them from doing something that you have a legitimate interest in protecting? Are they given reasonable compensation? Now, again, a bit of an argument about whether or not you have to do it, but generally it's not considered that you must provide compensation, but without compensation for the non-compete, then it can be quite difficult to enforce it. And then are the competitive activities in violation of a fiduciary duty or good faith? So in that regard, to what extent could you be seeing the employees acting wrongfully? Is that trying to take an unfair advantage of what they learned, or if they're misusing confidential information, for example? They're acting in a way which is inconsistent with their duties to you when they were an employee. That also weighs heavily. Interestingly, you have the Council of Labour Affairs, which is an advisory body which helps guide the law and make recommendations to the law. It also thinks that people should consider, well, what is the effect on the employee and how unequal in terms of bargaining power were the employee and employer? Was the employee naive? Did the employee really need the job, or were they coerced into the job? And did the employer explain why it actually needed the non-compete, or was it just put under the employee's nose and without any explanation were they asked to sign? Again, the Council of Labour Affairs, it's not legally binding, and the courts may or may not take it into account. But again, you can see there's that influence, which is, well, are we looking out for the employee here? It's very much thinking about the employee, not necessarily the employer. When liquidated damages are permitted in Taiwan. So again, contrast that to, say, Hong Kong, where liquidated damages are usually considered to be a penalty. Liquidated damages in Taiwan, it's a good way to give yourself some certainty. It's always hard to prove actual damages. The injunction may be helpful, but by the time you get to court, the non-compete might have run out. So at least if you get some liquidated damages, you have some real deterrent which you can hold against the employee should they choose to breach their obligations to you. Trade secret protection. Well, trade secrets are protected by statute in Taiwan. Again, it's the common definition which we're all used to. Not known generally to people involved who are involved with that type of information. So if they're in that particular field and they can't come across this type of information, it's information which is not generally known to them. It's information which has economic value because of its secrecy, and it's information which reasonable measures are taken to protect by the employer, by the whole person holding the trade secret. Now, there's a range of remedies under the trade secret protection laws in Taiwan, but very recently they've bolstered these significantly. If we just move on to the next slide, I'll talk a little about it. There's been a rising concern in Taiwan. If you look about the boom, I guess, in electronics, a lot of that was driven from Taiwan. In recent years, you've seen a lot of that manufacturing moving across the Taiwan Straits into mainland China. And there's been a great deal of concern out of Taiwan that, well, it's losing some of its competitive edge or it's losing some of its innovation to, and it's never said precisely, but I would say towards China. There's a high-profile case last year involving AU Optronics, a manufacturer of flat screens. Two executives of a large company that were accused of stealing the trade secrets and then taking them to China. And there was a lot of publicity given about the supposedly lavish lifestyles that the new employer gave these executives, the very high salaries. It was quite a high-profile case in Taiwan. And what ended up happening was that the prosecutor released the two individuals simply because I think there was a lack of evidence. So that really, pushed the executive yuan and the lawmakers in Taiwan, saying, well, what are we going to do about this? How do we protect our domestic businesses? So what they did is they made misuse of trade secrets a criminal offence. And it's a criminal offence now punishable for up to 5 years, as you can see here, or a fine of $1 million to $10 million Taiwanese dollars. And this is for a domestic breach. And then the interesting thing is the next point. If you're looking at an international breach, and it's funny how they express that because they talk about international as being China, Hong Kong, Macau, or any other country, it's clear where their concerns lie, then it's much greater penalty. So if you take the trade secrets out of Taiwan and then misuse them overseas, you can be punished up for 10 years with fines of up to $3 million to $50 million. There's also a multiplier in both cases. So if you get an unjust enrichment, your profits from misusing the trade secrets exceeds the amount of fine to which you're subject to, then there can be a multiplier applied to the fine which is applied up to 10 times in the case of international breaches. It's also a complaint-based process, so that's very helpful if you're a person who's had your trade secrets misappropriated. You can go to the prosecutor and you can initiate the complaint, and then upon presenting that to the prosecutor, that's the point where the prosecutor moves. Prosecutor only moves if a complaint is made. You also, once the complaint is made, have the ability to withdraw the complaint. And at that point, the prosecutor would withdraw from the case. So you are, in effect, able to use the criminal process to your advantage in a way that you're more used to seeing it in a civil environment. Finally, the last thing I wanted to mention about the statute is that it's made it a lot tougher for employers. Employers are expected to take all reasonable measures to prevent the misuse of other people's trade secrets. So if you have an employee coming from a competitor, for example, and then they start misusing their former employer's trade secrets, if you haven't taken all reasonable measures to stop that, and measures could be things like training, contractual obligations, quarantining the employee, it depends on the circumstances, you can be liable in the same way that the employee is. So you could be liable as an employer to criminal sanctions. It's a very big stick that I think the Taiwanese government's brought in, and it's clear that they're worried about it. And it's going to be interesting to see how some of the other jurisdictions around Asia keep reacting to this. Obviously, China's a very big presence in the area and is driving its economy forward very aggressively. And it's just been interesting to see how some of the different economies react to that. Taiwan trades extremely heavily with China, and yet we see here the concern, well, are we losing too much of an edge here? Hence the new law. I just wanted to move on at the very end, if we're talking about some of the cross-border considerations. What can you do when you've got someone who's, for example, a regional manager and responsible for a whole slew of regions countries throughout the region? Or they travel a lot. They're based in one country, but they travel a lot to another country. Choice of law is a very difficult question. In Europe, you're helped a lot by, well, there's a recognition of different legal systems, but they all try to work together. You're talking about completely different legal systems in Asia. So you really do want to think about the appropriate choice of law and an appropriate forum to bring in any complaints. Where is the work typically performed? That's often your best bet at saying, okay, well, where should I be looking to say that the contract is formed? What law should apply to that contract? In an employment context, it's usually where the work is performed. But then you also have to consider, well, when I'm looking at this employee, they might be based out of Hong Kong, but they're doing all their work on mainland China. So do I want a non-compete that's enforceable in Hong Kong, or do I want a non-compete that's going to be enforceable in mainland China? Because if you have a non-compete enforceable in Hong Kong, it may not do you any good if the person goes and sets up shop in China. So one of the things you can do is draft to the highest standard. So you make sure, okay, well, to the best that I can, I'm going to try and have a non-compete clause which satisfies most of the jurisdictions where this person's going to be doing business for me. Now, there's going to be a couple of places that it's just not going to work. India, I talked about. Malaysia is very similar. A post-termination non-compete is not enforceable. But you can certainly try and say, all right, well, I'm going to give them compensation. So that way I know that I'm balancing at least several countries. I'm also going to make sure I keep it restricted to the activities that they're actually involved in. So, you know, I'm covering off those common law countries. I'm not going to go for a very long period. There are steps that you can take to ensure that, well, at least even if you've got a contract subject to one law, if you go and try and enforce it elsewhere via a court judgment or however else, you've got the opportunity to do so. And then finally, you might get a judgment, but if the employee has no presence in that jurisdiction, is it really going to help you? So think about, well, where are the employee's most vital interests and property? So if you are able to bring an action against the employee and you win, you actually have a prospect of getting something back against the employee. So you might be able to get damages because they have property in the jurisdiction, or they live in the jurisdiction and they can be subject to the jurisdiction of the court, even though they're often working overseas. There are a number of these alternatives that are open, but it is one of the hardest and, I think, biggest challenges facing companies these days. The workforce is so mobile. People move all around the world. And you can no longer just assume that protecting yourself in one region is going to give you adequate protection from that employee when they leave and they start competing in a completely different country. So you're seeing employers doing some imaginative things, multiple employment contracts, splitting salary across different regions. But, you know, it's still something you should always consider. Just don't go in with your form for that country and saying, well, for a person who's going to be working in several countries, just don't go with that form for your country and saying, okay, well, this is going to be fine. With that very quick trip across Asia, I hope to have informed you a little bit more about some of the considerations that you need to consider and keep in mind. I'm going to be turning it over now to my partner, Robert Milligan.
Thank you very much, Dominic. That was very comprehensive and very easy to follow. I appreciate that. For our audience, I wanted to provide the CLE code. The CLE code for today's program is SS9583. Again, the CLE code is SS9583. And with that, we'll turn to the last portion of today's webinar. And I should note that we will have a question and answer session at the end of the presentation where Juan Lee and Dominic will answer some questions, as well as Leon Mao. Our last topic is the challenges that U.S. companies face in pursuing trade secret and non-compete claims against foreign individuals and companies that they face, essentially trying to pursue those claims against those actors in the United States. And we're going to discuss ITC actions, the Economic Espionage Act, and some recent high-profile cases. Before we get into that, we just wanted to provide a general overview of how the non-compete and trade secret laws work in the United States. We understand we have an international audience today, and we've provided somewhat of a compare and contrast, so we wanted to provide some basic fundamentals about how the system in the United States works. In the United States, non-disclosure, non-compete, and non-solicitation of customer and employee provisions are typically allowed in a majority of states in the United States. But that's not to say that there's not a lot of variety in those states as to what is enforceable as far as the duration, length, and scope of those particular restrictive covenants. Now, many states in the United States follow the rule of reason, and that essentially means that the restrictive covenant, the non-compete, for instance, needs to be reasonable in scope, duration and geographical limitation. And as far as what is what's the basis of law, it's a combination, and it depends upon each state, but certainly some states have laws that permit non-competes pursuant to statute. Other states permit non-competes pursuant to the common law. As far as trade secrets go, 48 states in the United States have adopted some version of the Uniform Trade Secret Act, which is a statute that protects trade secrets and allows plaintiffs to bring actions in civil court for trade secret misappropriation. The lone holdouts that have not yet adopted the Uniform Trade Secret Act are Massachusetts and New York, and that's not to say that trade secrets are not protected in those particular states, but they haven't adopted the statute, and trade secrets are protected under the common law in those particular states. Now, trade secrets are also protected by the criminal laws, and that's where the Economic Espionage Act comes up. And certainly, there's been a lot of high-profile prosecutions under the Economic Espionage Act, and it allows the government, the federal government, to bring claims against individuals, corporations that misappropriate trade secrets. There's also a number of other federal statutes that allow redress for the government as well as companies for trade secret misappropriation. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, it's a statute more geared toward unauthorized access of computers, but in some instances, claims are brought that are really about the theft of information under that particular statute. And some U.S. states also have similar computer misuse statutes that make it a crime to abuse computers and unauthorized access or unauthorized permission of those particular computers. For instance, California has a statute, the Penal Code Section 502, that permits, that allows parties to bring both criminal and civil actions for violation of that statute for unpermitted access to their computers. Now, in comparison to some of the countries that Juan Lee and Leon and Dominic discussed, in the United States, you know, variety is definitely is found throughout the United States. Consideration, meaning do you have to pay for your non-compete? In many European countries and even Asian countries, in order to have a post-term non-compete, you actually have to pay for it. Not so in many U.S. States. Initial employment and continued employment can be sufficient for a post-term non-compete, non-solicitation, and non-disclosure agreement. Essentially, giving an employee a job can serve as the basis, the consideration for a post-term non-compete. Another key issue that often comes up in the United States is whether you can enforce a non-compete if the employer is the one who terminates the employment relationship. In some states, that's not permitted, but in a large number of states, that is permitted. And typically in the United States, as opposed to liquidated damages or damages, injunctive relief is typically the top litigation goal in non-compete litigation. If you have a key employee, often the goal is to keep them from going from your employment, your company's employment, to a chief competitor, and oftentimes you'll run into court to try to get an injunction from either a state or a federal judge. That's not to say that all states in the United States permit non-compete. There are some states such as California, South Dakota, and Oklahoma that do not permit non-competes in the typical employment relationship. Choice of law provisions are often very important in non-compete litigation in the United States. Typically, they're enforceable, but if you use a out-of-state non-compete, if you use an out-of-state choice of law provision in your non-compete agreement, the forum state will scrutinize and figure out whether that particular choice of law provision may violate the public policy of a forum state. And so that typically comes up with some employers who try to use a out-of-state choice of law provision with their California employees. And there's well-established case law in California that California courts have found that you cannot impose a non-compete against a California employee by using an out-of-state choice of law provision. And that comes up in many different instances across the United States about trying to use a choice of law provision. And then there's a lot of variation also among states concerning whether non-competes can be binding against employees in mergers and acquisitions and buy-sell type transactions. The typical rule of thumb is that they can be, but there is variations amongst the 50 states as far as how far they'll go in that. And typically we see a lot of litigation where an employee and their new employer who feel that a non-compete is overly broad or invalid, they often will go on the offensive and file a suit first to try to get clarification from the court that the covenant is either overly broad or needs to be narrowed in scope. And oftentimes you'll have a scenario where you may have a race to judgment where the employer is trying to enforce a non-compete perhaps in their forum state, and the employee and the new employer may be trying to challenge it in another state because their law is more favorable, for instance, California. And there's often a race to judgment, and the key there is that under the U.S. Constitution, there will be full faith and credit for the first party to get a judgment in general. And so oftentimes you can see dual-track litigation where parties are trying to get to judgment first. As far as the Uniform Trade Secret Act that's been adopted in 48 states, it provides remedies including injunctive relief, lost profits, unjust enrichment, and in certain instances a reasonable royalty, exemplary damages, often two times your actual damages, and attorney's fees are available. So it can be a very lucrative and a very attractive remedy for plaintiffs whose trade secrets have been misappropriated. And though it varies, in some states, the general statute of limitations for bringing a claim is 3 years. Even amongst the U.S. states, though, even though that 48 have adopted it, there are differences concerning the interpretation of the Uniform Trade Secret Act. Some states have adopted different versions and haven't adopted certain provisions of the Uniform Trade Secret Act. And so the case law construing, even the case law construing the identical statutes varies amongst the 48 states that have adopted it. A key example is some jurisdictions recognize the inevitable disclosure doctrine, and that's essentially the concept that if a key employee leaves your employment and goes to a direct competitor in the same position, that they're going to inevitably disclose those trade secrets. And some jurisdictions, some states have adopted the inevitable disclosure doctrine. Other states, such as California, haven't adopted it. So there can be a wide variety, and that's why it's often important to have a handle on your particular state if you're going to be pursuing litigation. And another thing that has come up recently under the Trade Secret Act is whether or not you're precluded from bringing other causes of action that you would typically see in data theft and employee raiding type cases, common law claims such as unfair competition or tortious interference with contract, or if the gist of the actual claim is the theft of information, that you would only be allowed to bring a trade secret misappropriation claim as well as a breach of contract claim, but any of those other typical common law civil causes of action would be precluded. And typically, in comparison to other countries, it varies, but generally in the United States, civil discovery, the taking of depositions, the exchange of documents, is permitted in trade secret cases, but there is often requirements that the plaintiff identify the exact trade secret that was misappropriated first before discovery is commenced, and there often can be protracted battles about whether the trade secret was identified with sufficient particularity in order to allow discovery to go forward. And so as far as some of the challenges that companies in the United States face in dealing with individuals, companies, or governments that misappropriate U.S. trade secrets, personal jurisdiction is often a key challenge. It may be that these actors have no real connection to the United States. The misappropriation may have occurred by way of computer, that there was no actual theft that occurred physically in the United States, and it may be a situation where an individual left and then shopped the wares or the goods, the trade secrets, within a foreign country, and a foreign manufacturer picked up the trade secrets from that individual without any knowledge, and then begins to sort of mass produce the item or whatnot. And so if you were to sue that particular foreign company, you may have some challenges if you're in state or federal court in the United States in actually bringing the lawsuit whatsoever under a challenge by way of personal jurisdiction. Another challenge is, in order for the lawsuit to go forward, you have to serve a copy of the complaint against the defendant. And service doesn't necessarily always mean physical service. There's often requirements as far as how you go about serving a complaint. And we've been seeing a lot of activity as far as what is effective service of process of a complaint on a foreign actor. And this is coming up a lot in the criminal realm, and we've seen some cases recently where things that you thought may be a sufficient service are turning out not to be sufficient service, and the courts are dismissing the lawsuits. Things such as certified mail or serving the particular complaint on a officer of a subsidiary of a U.S. subsidiary of a foreign corporation being deemed not sufficient service of process. There's also can be challenges with respect to enforcement of judgment, and that comes up in the context of sort of when you have the empty chair defendant, where the defendant the court finds that there is either personal jurisdiction and there's sufficient service of process, and the plaintiff is able to get a judgment, but there's no way to enforce the judgment because the actor lives abroad, and it's either a challenge or not even possible to enforce a U.S. judgment against that particular actor in a foreign country. And other challenges can be the remedies themselves, because your main remedy may be obtaining injunctive relief, but actually getting an injunction from a state or federal judge in the United States and trying to use that injunction to prohibit activities that are occurring abroad is often a very big challenge as far as whether the foreign court would honor that whatsoever, and it can be a hollow victory in getting that sort of injunctive relief. And then discovery can often be very expensive, particularly when you're dealing with international misappropriation cases. There could be a lot of travel involved. Documents that are key to the case and the computer evidence can be abroad, and there can be significant challenges as far as costs and discovery go. We'll get into a further discussion of the T. and Rui case, but that's a very significant case that provides some U.S. companies with hope as far as how to deal with the situation where their trade secrets are being mass-produced abroad, and they don't feel like they have a recourse in U.S. Your typical U.S. federal or state court. The T. and Rui case involved the International Trade Commission. And in that particular case, the U.S. company was able to get a very important remedy, and that remedy was an exclusionary order, essentially prohibiting the importation of railroad wheels, in this particular case, into the United States. And the corollary to that was obviously the sale of such wheels in the United States. And that was under the International Trade Commission's governing statute, Section 337. And we've blogged on this particular case in the past on our blog, tradesecretslaw.com, if you want more information about it. But essentially, it allowed the Section 337 gives the ITC the authority to investigate and grant relief against products that are manufactured abroad using misappropriated trade secrets. So it essentially allows U.S. rights holders the ability to seal the borders through customs if they're able to show that there was trade secret misappropriation, even if it only occurred abroad. And so I want to talk briefly about a common scenario is what happens when the misappropriation occurs abroad. So imagine a scenario, Company A and Company B. They have factories in the United States and China. And B's factory improperly accessed trade secret information from A's factory. And all of the misappropriation occurred in China. Nothing occurred in the United States as far as misappropriation goes. B then uses the trade secrets to make products that are shipped to the United States to compete with A's products. And the typical question and the typical scenario that we hear from clients is, can A seek a remedy? And the answer is obviously yes. And what are the different scenarios? Well, one, you can sue in U.S. state or federal court. We've talked about some of the challenges there with respect to personal jurisdiction and service of process and essentially having a judgment against a empty chair defendant where you have no ability to get any sort of relief, injunctive, or money damages against that empty chair defendant. You can obviously sue in the Chinese court system, and Wan Li and Leon discussed that China may provide a viable relief for a company in that scenario, but there are a lot of challenges and scenarios that you have to meet in order to be effective in the Chinese court system. And the other alternative, and where there is somewhat of a solution here, is this the U.S. International Trade Commission. And we talked about one of the remedies being an exclusionary order. A little bit of background about the United States International Trade Commission. It's an administrative agency that's based in Washington, D.C., and it's responsible for investigating trade matters that affect U.S. industry. It prepares trade reports for President and Congress, and it investigates trade disputes, including IP-related trade disputes. Typically, you see a lot of ITC action involving patents. But they also do investigations with respect to trade secrets, and we've seen recently an uptick in the number of ITC investigations related to trade secrets. Over the years, we've seen an uptick in general in the number of Section 337 investigations. In 2002, there was just over 40 Section 337 investigations, but as of 2011, it was well over 120 investigations, and I predict and expect that we'll see more Section 337 investigations, primarily because of that extraordinary remedy that is provided under the ITC. And as far as the sort of the nuts and bolts of Section 337 investigations, it allows the Commission to investigate unfair methods of competition and unfair acts in the importation of articles, the threat or effect of which is to destroy or substantially injure an industry in the United States. It's important to point out that in order to use the ITC and 337, you don't actually have to be a U.S. company. As long as you have industry in the United States, that is sufficient. And we talked a little bit about under the exclusion order, and that comes from the U.S. Federal Code 19 U.S.C. 337, essentially allows the commission to direct that articles violating the provision be excluded from entry into the United States. And the typical scenario of how the nuts and bolts of how a 337 investigation occurs is that the complaint, the ITC complaint, is filed by the IP owner, the complainant, and the accused party is the respondent. And as far as you may be thinking, well, I thought you mentioned that there's often personal jurisdiction issues. Well, that's the beauty of the 337 proceeding, is that instead of personal jurisdiction, it provides for in rem jurisdiction. And that essentially means jurisdiction over the property, over the imported articles. And so personal jurisdiction over the respondent is not required. And it even gets better because as far as service of process, instead of having to use the complicated procedure under the Hague Convention to achieve service of process, in an ITC investigation, first-class airmail service is sufficient. So if the misappropriation is occurring in a foreign country, the way to commence the action is to file it with the ITC, and a service is, can be accomplished just by airmail service. One of the requirements is that the complainant must show the existence of a U.S. industry, and I highlight that merely to show that you don't have to be a U.S. corporation to avail yourselves of the ITC. Wanted to get a little bit more into the Tian Rui case. It's gone by a number of different names, Amstead versus Tian Rui litigation, or the steel railway wheel case, but it is essentially about the attempted importation of rail wheels into the United States. And as far as the timeline goes, the complaint was filed with the ITC in August of 2008, and there was an evidentiary hearing and a bench trial in August of 2009, and the administrative law judge issued his particular opinion in October of 2009, and an exclusion order, you know, prohibiting the importation of the rail wheels was issued on February of 2010. So you can see that this is, relatively speaking, pretty swift relief as far as how quickly they were able to obtain relief once they learned of the misappropriation. And you can see this is the actual language as far as the remedy that was provided in the Tian Rui case. There was both an exclusionary order that lasted 10 years, prohibiting the entry of the rail products in the United States, and there was also a cease and desist order prohibiting the respondents from importing, selling, or marketing the rail wheels in the United States. Now, after the ITC had issued their ruling, the case was appealed to the Federal Circuit, and the Federal Circuit is the federal judiciary that hears appeals of ITC decisions. And the key issue on appeal was whether Section 357 applies to imported goods produced through the exploitation of trade secrets in which the act of misappropriation occurs abroad. So in this particular case, it was not challenged that misappropriation occurred. All that was challenged is that you couldn't bring a ITC action on the basis where it was undisputed that that no misappropriation occurred in the United States and that it solely occurred abroad. Now, the Federal Circuit focused on the nexus between the imported articles and the unfair methods of competition rather than on where the misappropriation occurs. And the essential portion of its holding was when the Federal Circuit said the Commission's interpretation of Section 337 does not, as the dissent contends, give it the authority to police Chinese business practice. It only sets the conditions under which products may be imported into the United States. So it did not matter that the misappropriation occurred abroad. All that mattered was that the products may be imported into the United States. There was a vigorous dissent in this Federal Circuit decision, and it may be a precursor to cases that come up in the future, because I highlighted the fact that it was undisputed that misappropriation occurred. That was not something that was ever challenged at the ITC. The dissent had serious problems with the Federal Circuit's decision and essentially said that the Commission's decision to bar imports because of acts of unfair competition occurred entirely in China. And it pointed out that while, you know, Tian Rui was not a sympathetic litigant and had poached employees to obtain confidential information, none of the acts occurred in the United States, and there was no violation of United States law to amount to an unfair trade practice under the statute. But again, that was just the dissent. And the petitioner was able to obtain that extraordinary remedy. There's been two recent cases that are active, ongoing cases. The first case that I wanted to highlight for you was a case involving wind turbine technology, and it's essentially a Chinese wind turbine maker. Sinovel was charged with IP theft by the U.S. attorney under the Economic Espionage Act. This is a case brought in the United States state of Wisconsin, and essentially they alleged that there was a theft of source code from an American corporation, American Superductor's computer system, to run these wind turbines. And this is going to be a precursor to, I think, a lot of cases that we may see in the future if the Department of Justice continues to sue under the Economic Espionage Act, and that is a challenge to service. Sinovel has filed a motion to quash the summons on the basis that there's no jurisdiction and there's no proper service of Sinovel by filing the complaint and attempting to try to serve the complaint. And the real challenge there is it's primarily a Chinese-based company, and it does not appear that they're going to be able to effectuate service, and the case may be dismissed. There's a pending motion to quash the summons. Another case, and I think this highlights some of the conflict that's occurring in this area, is that there's a case in having to do with resin for tires. And essentially, an ITC action was commenced in favor of an American rubber manufacturer, the SI Group. And they brought an action, and they, at least at the initial determination, it appears that a exclusionary order may be granted in their favor, prohibiting the Chinese manufacturer, Sino-Legend, from importing tires with the resin into the United States. But the interesting aspect of the case is that SI Group also commenced an action in China prior to the ITC action. And recently, decisions were released for the first time on the same day. And while the ITC in its initial determination found in favor of the American company, and it appears that they may issue an exclusionary order, the Chinese court found an opposite conclusion and essentially found that there was not, that the information at issue was public information, and that there was not trade secret misappropriation. And so, again, the case is at an early stage at the ITC, and if it does get once a final determination is made and if it is appealed to the Federal Circuit, it'll be very interesting to see how the Federal Circuit rules, because this case is a little bit different from the Tian Rui case in the sense that the allegations of misappropriation are being challenged by the Chinese company. They are being challenged at the ITC. And here it's clear that there's a conflict between essentially U.S. law and or essentially the ITC's actions and Chinese law. One of the holdings in the Tian Rui case is that they did not believe that their ruling was inconsistent with what would occur in China and Chinese law. But, of course, here in this new action, the SI Group case, there's already been a ruling in China that the trade secret misappropriation didn't occur. So whether the Federal Circuit and the vigorous dissent will hold the day in that case remains to be seen. With that, I'd like to get into some questions. We received some questions that I want to throw out to our panel. First, some questions that we received for Leon and Juan Lee. Leon and Juan Lee, are there variations amongst the various provinces in China concerning enforcement of non-competes similar to the differences in the United States?
I think you are right. It's quite different. As I mentioned earlier, it's different province, different city. Maybe the local rules slightly different, and also the qualities of the qualification, qualities of the judge may read things differently. So I think it will be more variant if you compare with the difference in the states.
And one thing that's common in the United States is oftentimes parties, instead of going to court, they will go to arbitration. And we have a question here about do parties arbitrate non-compete or trade secret disputes in China?
Usually, I think is both parties will pre-decide or pre-agree. Once they have a dispute, they should go to the court proceedings or arbitration if it's in the commercial context. But in the employment context, the first stage, you always sort of go to the arbitration.
I see. And a question for you, Dominic.
Sure.
And it has to do with your discussion of Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Japan. In those various jurisdictions, which one of those jurisdictions is it easier to enforce a non-compete? And a related question is, do you have to pay for the post-term termination non-compete in those jurisdictions? And if so, how much?
It's really a qualitative assessment, and it's a hard one to make. But if I had to, if my life was on the line, I'd probably say Japan might be the country or the jurisdiction which has the which might give the employer the best chance. In terms of paying for the non-compete after the employment, Hong Kong you do not need to, and it doesn't really matter whether you do or don't, though some judges may unconsciously or subconsciously take account of this. In Japan and Taiwan, you don't have to pay for it, but it's certainly a very strong factor in both jurisdictions to deciding whether or not the non-compete is reasonable. There's no quantum set, but again, the richer the amount paid, the more chance there is of it being reasonable.
Thank you, Dominic. And a question for Juan Leon and Leon. What are the key provisions that you typically recommend companies include in their vendor agreements to protect their confidential information and trade secrets in China?
I think in that space, very similar to the practice around the world, like in the United States and Europe. So the confidential clause should be put in, and also various restrictive covenants well built in to protect the client in their operation in China. So in that regard, it's very, very similar to the other jurisdiction.
And do you find that choice of law or forum selection clauses, is that an important issue in China?
You are right. In relation to any commercial agreement, the choice of law and forums are always big issues. So we always look at this part very seriously. And also, case by case, we may suggest the client to select an international arbitration. But very often, the foreign jurisdictions or foreign law may not be the best choice. For example, the enforcement of the judgment in relation to the trade secret and also IP right issues, the foreign court judgment may not be recognized and enforceable in China. So may not foreign law and also the forum may not be the best choice. So it really case by case to see whether it should be in China or in an overseas jurisdiction.
Oh, very good. And I think you covered this, but maybe just clarify for our audience. We have a question. Is injunctive relief common in trade secret non-compete disputes in China, and is it hard to obtain?
It is not common. Leon just mentioned about the Shanghai Intermediate Court. It is the first such ruling in the whole China. And so that's why the in the legal market and judicial world, they all held this is the landmark ruling. So back to your question is, injunctive relief is not common, but I think it will become common soon.
And I believe you covered this also, but we had a question. Must employers pay for post-termination non-competes in China?
You're right. Issues always. When you're talking about the compensation for the non-compete, it is always after termination.
I see. And Leon mentioned the Shanghai decision involving Eli Lilly. Maybe provide a little context if you know. Do you know what type of relief the court provided in the Eli Lilly case?
It's a permanent injunctive relief, not temporary.
I see. And one thing that often comes up in the United States and in some of the countries that I know Dominic is familiar with is courts will often modify, reform, or what they call blue pencil a non-compete if it's overly broad. You know, for instance, if the geographic scope is too large, it covers too many territories. Is that something that Chinese courts do as well, that they'll modify or reform overly broad non-competes?
No, usually the Chinese court will support the agreement, the clause in the non-compete agreement. So the covenant can cover all the country, so it's fine.
Well, great. Thank you to the three of you. I really appreciate it, Wan Li, Leon, and Dominic. I think this was a great presentation. And you know, for more information regarding these topics, we'll be having more about China and international trade secret issues and non-compete issues on our blog, tradesecretslaw.com. And you'll also see in our slide, we have the contact information for Wan Li, Dominic, and myself. Thank you so much, and have a great day.
Thank you again for joining us today. This concludes our web conference. You may now disconnect.